But I think the politicians and even the prime ministers are puppets. They're puppets of people who have greater power than them. You know, quite who they are, whether we're talking individuals or organizations or industries, you know, perhaps, I don't know, probably haven't got time to go into that, but, you know, those that appear to run the country probably don't. You know, they have fewer powers than they imagine they will have. When they get elected, they probably realize, so we can't do that then. We can't fulfill that promise either. Okay, we'll have to water that down. We'll have to do a U-turn here. And so it goes on.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to this year, of course, in the mid-2011, we get another Guardian report on the Bilderberg Group, because, you know, in the last year we actually had one. And I think that was a groundbreaking thing, because it took it out of the conspiracy theory into reality, that we actually had that chap, I think, I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now.
I can't remember his name either. But he, he was saying, no, seriously, folks, why are these really powerful and important people meeting in secret? You've got heads of state, you've got heads of the economy, you've got industrialists, media moguls. You know, why are they meeting in secret? What are they talking about? What's on the agenda? And why aren't they telling us about these meetings? You know, it's a fair question, isn't it?
It is indeed
why
a fair
question.
Why
would they all get together just to play golf and have a nice time? They're obviously there to talk business, but what their business is, what they're planning, well, we don't know. And I think we've got a right to know. Got a right to be concerned and ask questions. But the good thing is, I think people are really starting to wake up now. People are really starting to see in much greater numbers that there is stuff going on that they weren't previously aware of. You know, people are sharing information. People are, you know, waking each other up and saying, have you heard about this? And pointing to a story about, you know, whatever it may be. There are so many different areas. You know, it's just, I mean, you've got a weekly show and you're not going to run out of content.
No, we never do.
But people, I really believe people are starting to wake up. People are starting to realise that things aren't right. That there's a reason things aren't right. That these things aren't happening by accident. And what woke me up to that was the banking crisis. You know, the economic collapse. This is 2008. And they kept saying, oh, because the banks have gone bust, we've got to give them all our money. And I thought, or why don't we just let them go bust?
Yep.
Oh, we can't do that because they're so big. They're too big to fail.
And why?
Well, now they're talking about the Spanish economy, saying the Spanish economy is too big to save.
That's incredible.
It is, isn't it? So the reason we've got these cuts, these austerity measures, is because we've given hundreds of billions of pounds and just of taxpayers' money that was in the Treasury. We've just poured it into the banking sector. We were told that's so that they can keep lending to small businesses and homeowners, which they then didn't do. Nobody could get a loan or a mortgage. Businesses were going bust. They weren't getting that lending. But what the banks were doing were propping up their own balance sheets by going back to the casino of investment banking, trying to make some more money on some dodgy derivatives and credit default swaps and all these crazy contrived mechanisms for making dodgy money. You know, this sort of Ponzi scheme of financial instruments that nobody really understands, but the economy somehow depends on. And I just thought, no, I don't buy this. I just, there's something wrong here. You know, we have to give all our money to the banks. You know, if an industry goes bust, like all our car manufacturing, you know, if it goes bust, usually it goes bust. It's quite rare that the government would step in and say, no, we will rescue it.
Well, it did, actually. I mean, it happened here in Birmingham.
Well,
I mean, they didn't step in. What I'm saying is they let them go bust. There was, I think Sy can step in here as well. I think there was a, was it a Rolls-Royce?
It was MG Rover, actually.
That's right, yes.
Fiasco.
And, of course, recently we had the company that was actually, in the end, I think was bought by Russia.
The MG Rover was actually bought out by
the Chinese. Is it Shanghai or Beijing?
They moved the headquarters to Shanghai.
They basically dismantled it and shipped it out to China.
Yep. So indeed, yeah, there's so much we can say, and first of all, thank you, Steve, for taking up so much of your time. We really appreciate it. And just before we do sort of finish the conversation for this particular show, we do hope that perhaps you can join us much more in the future.
Oh yeah, I'd be happy to. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I'd be happy to chat to you again.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's been really enlightening. We look forward to speaking much more in the future.
Okay.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, that was Steve Jolly there with a fascinating interview, you could say, but it's a fascinating round of news and current affairs, you know, something very, very different and something which gets you thinking. Good evening and welcome back to Behind the Headlines here on the 25th of the 1st of 2011 on Unity FM 93.5, Heart of the City. We are now joined, of course, by Tony Gosling from BCR FM, that's Bristol City Radio. And as of always, we have a heap of topics to talk about.
Absolutely, we do.
We have, of course, a lot of censorship happening in the media right now. What with likes of WikiLeaks, etc., and many other things that are going on. And I think censorship is a very, very big issue, actually. And I believe that Tony has a few words on censorship.
Yeah, I mean, just to let you know, we're starting a series on censorship later this week on BCFM. That is the website www.bcfm.org.uk.
Ah, so it's BCFM. Sorry, my mistake. Yes.
Thisweek.org.uk, website for that. And we're starting a whole series, which will be running over a couple of months on censorship, because over Christmas, you know, as you do, you're kind of sitting around the fire and thinking about things. I actually came up with something like 15 different ways in which the news and information that we get in our newspapers and on broadcast TV and radio is being censored, and so I thought I'd just list a lot of them and do a little piece each week. And we've got a bit of a scoop really this week by talking to a producer, a former BBC producer from BBC Glasgow, Brian Barr, who produced one of the most controversial investigative documentary series the BBC had ever made, and it was made back in 1987. And as part of that interview, he himself says that there's actually no way that a programme like that could ever be made today, certainly not within the BBC. And they found out afterwards that some of the people at the highest level, at the Board of Governors of the BBC, and also the Deputy Director General himself, were actually former military intelligence and senior military officers, unbeknownst to them at the time. And they were just sort of civilian employees at the BBC, but clearly their military background influenced their decision on whether or not the public had a right to know. And so that series was called Secret Society, and it aired in 1987, towards the end of the Thatcher decade. And it was looking at all sorts of aspects of government secrecy, and for anything from money for military projects being smuggled past the politicians by the military so that they didn't realise where this money was going. There's another programme all about what's called the Secret Constitution, which was considered so sensitive that it couldn't actually be shown because there was a general election going to be happening in a few months' time, and that this might actually influence people's decision on who to vote for at the general election, and also reduce confidence in people's faith in democracy, because it was clear in that programme that many of the most important decisions that were being made by the Thatcher government back in the 1980s were actually being made by secret committees, that even people who are members of the cabinet weren't allowed to know what was going on those committees or even who was on those committees.
Shocking.
Yes, it was in a really devastating programme, and it was designed to look at the extent to which secrecy has been eroding democracy in Britain. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, whatever they detected back in those days has been even advanced since then. There's even more secrecy now involved in government. Even though we've got a Freedom of Information Act, it seems that some of the most important things we need to know about, things to do with, for example, emergency planning in a time of war, and data protection to do with the data that the government collects on us, is actually in a more worrying state than it was back in the 1980s. The only problem is, of course, that the BBC simply isn't making series like this. That was the very well-known investigative journalist Duncan Campbell,
yes,
working with Brian Barr, that got this programme out. And as I said, he's saying that, you know, we had all sorts of trouble getting this programme aired. There was one of the series that was never aired. In fact, it was only aired on Channel 4 after Channel 4 started. The BBC wouldn't air it at all. And at one point during the dispute, the special branch turned up at their offices in BBC Glasgow and emptied their entire office out, including every bit of research they'd done over a period of many months, into transit vans and then took it away. But it turned out that the warrant that they used was the wrong warrant, so they had to bring it all back again, go away, get another, the correct warrant, and then they took all the stuff away again. So it was all a little bit farcical, very sensitive, but actually what was happening was the special branch, which really is sort of parlance for MI5, internal security liaison with the police, what they were doing was essentially closing down a legitimate investigative documentary program, which was looking at secrecy and corruption in the government. And they were trying to get it covered up under the guise of national security. Of course, what was really going on was that they were just trying to cover up embarrassment and actually criminal, potentially anyway, criminal misuse of public money by government officials and particularly by military procurement people. And so that is what we're going to be kicking off with on Friday, and then we're going to be looking at all sorts of other types of ways in which the information we get as the public, which we need in a democracy to make informed decisions, is being censored and by all sorts of different methods, you know, from everything from the sort of thing I've been describing, that is, you know, threats by the police and by the military against broadcasters and legal action, potentially warrants, this kind of thing, all the way through to the subtle intimidation of individual journalists that goes on by their managers and editors to make sure that they toe the company line, so to speak. I mean, for example, here in Bristol, we have the company line at the local newspaper, the Bristol Evening Post, is generally very much in support of building a new stadium on a greenfield site on the outskirts of the city by yes. Bristol City Football Club. And everybody who works at the newspaper knows that this is the paper's line, and so they're very, very careful. They know that they will possibly there will be consequences if they put stuff in the newspaper which is contrary to that point of view, unless it's in the letters page, maybe, without first informing the editor. So there's very little real freedom, obviously, when this kind of atmosphere exists at a news organisation where there is a company line on a particular subject. The employees are simply in fear of their job, losing their job, if they step outside the safe zone.
Perhaps a more popular example in recent times would be Vince Cable, of course, you know, who made his remarks and then was very quickly told, you know, to change the remarks he made and to apologise. Is that, in a sense, a form of censorship as well?
Well, of course it is. When your government, people in central positions in the government aren't allowed to speak their mind to their constituents, I think that's the big issue with the partial sacking, if you want to call it that, of Vince Cable. Is simply that these meetings are confidential meetings between constituents and MPs, and what the Murdoch via the Telegraph empire is doing there, and of course there is actually quite a lot of friendship between the Murdoch empire and the Barclay twins, who live in tax exiles in the Isle of Sark in the Channel Islands. What they did was to violate that privacy and abuse their right to, you know, which really reflects incredibly badly on these types of journalists, I think, you know. And also what I would like to see is, why didn't the Telegraph go and send somebody to spy on the secret meetings that James Murdoch was having with David Cameron over Christmas? Apparently we've been told today that Cameron was meeting up, having private supper lunches with Rupert Murdoch's son, the heir to the massive media empire, one of the biggest in the world. And I would have thought that actually it was much more in the public interest to be exposing what was going on at those meetings rather than to do a rather creepy thing, which is to pretend to be a constituent and out Vince Cable's opposition to Murdoch's having a virtual monopoly on British media, in fact extending his existing power even more. I mean, this shows that the investigative journalists that are out there seem to be picking on the wrong targets. I don't think Vince, certainly within his constituency surgery, is a legitimate target, when what he's doing is actually fighting for the rights of the people in order to try and stop Rupert Murdoch extending his media empire so that he's starting to control, you know, more and more and more of what we see, hear and think. And then, of course, you know, this is a sort of psychological warfare campaign against the public, where Murdoch is deciding what we see, hear and think. And I think this is absolutely outrageous that this is all done for private profit, and that other people can come along to Murdoch and offer him cash or favours in order for him to take a particular line on a particular subject. I mean, we're slipping down a very, very slippery slope to a sort of almost a 1984 type situation where our press becomes controlled, a little bit like the press was in Russia under the Soviet era, you know, a Stalinist-style press which has a particular line, and that, of course, is not a free press.
No, indeed. Another contrast to all this as well, of course, is Blair, again recently in news, purging his memoirs, his secret conversations with President Bush, or former US President Bush, prior to the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
Well, this is really interesting, isn't it? And it was George Galloway has been one of the people who's been pointing this out, as he did on Question Time last week, is that this is a quasi-judicial hearing. There is nothing proper about this Chilcot hearings. Mm. For a start, if you're going to have a proper inquiry into something, you've got to have the legal right to subpoena witnesses, in other words, to force people to come and testify, or else possibly try and flee the country. But we can't have people walking the streets who have evidence on the Iraq inquiry in Britain who just simply say, oh, well, actually, I don't fancy going to this inquiry. It's farcical, and it also means that important documents relating to what they're trying to do to this inquiry Tony Blair is able, and Gus O'Donnell are able to just simply say, actually, no, we don't want to turn these documents over. It makes an absolute mockery of what Chilcot is supposedly trying to do.
If that's the case, Tony, if I may step in here, if that's the case, and I mean, is there any point to this Chilcot inquiry? I mean,
well, of course, yes, there is, and that is a rolling press conference. It's a sort of a way of controlling the way that the discussion and debate about the failures of the Iraq war comes out. Of course, this is an absolute massive, massive disaster in foreign policy. First of all, we had the biggest demonstration we've ever seen in Britain, between 2 and 3 million people on the streets of London saying, no, don't do it. Tony Blair decides to ignore them and carries on anyway to carry on with his invasion based on a lie, based on this whole thing about weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be nonsense. Now, Saddam was no saint, of course, but we're actually facing now in Iraq a far, far worse situation than there was during the time of Saddam. What happened is he cleared out many of his opposition by the time of even by 1991, when the first Gulf War happened, and it was the Iraq was relatively settling down, you know. And what's happened now is last week we had something like 5-6 very, very serious bomb attacks, hundreds of people killed. It's like the bomb attacks are happening every day. People are dying every single day in a kind of random, violent orgy in a way that was absolutely unthinkable under Saddam. So what's happened is the country has been brought to its knees, bombed back to the Stone Age, and, of course, heads should roll. This is why the Chilcot inquiry is happening as it is heads will not roll. Mm. All that will happen is we will get a fairly controlled release of information. In fact, we know that everybody knows that we have a minute delay as well in the video and the audio feed from the Chilcot inquiry. And it's all going to be released in a fairly nice, controlled way, and nobody's going to be upset. Certainly none of the people who were behind the lies that led to the war are going to be upset by this inquiry. And therefore, I think the whole thing is really kind of a news management exercise rather than an... And what we should have, of course, is a proper, legal, lawful public inquiry. And you speak to anybody in the judicial profession, and they will tell you the same. If you're going to have an inquiry into something, do it as a public inquiry. And there are many, many important incidents that have happened in Britain, including the 7/7 London bombings, where there still has not been any proper public inquiry. I mean, if there's a train crash or something, that's what happens. You have a public inquiry, a proper look at what happened, and then the entire story can be laid to rest. And the people involved can be fairly certain that they know what happened that day. With the 7/7 London bombings, this simply hasn't happened, and neither has it happened with all of the criminal behaviour which led to an illegal invasion of a sovereign country, Iraq.
Well, I mean, we already had a couple of these inquiries relating to Iraq, and one of them was, I mean, I remember back in just after the fall of Saddam, was again a BBC inquiry. We had one again in the media relating to Andrew Gilligan and his reporting. Some of the BBC executives didn't have to resign over their way of reporting the Iraq war. And then after that, we had another inquiry just after the death of David Kelly, if I'm correct in thinking. And we haven't learned much from those inquiries. So, I mean, are we really...
Well, there hasn't been... what I'm so talking about here is a proper judicial inquiry. That is to say, that looks at all the facts. I mean, when there's a big incident takes place, it's no good having an inquest, which is just designed to look into one specific suspicious death. What you do is you have a public inquiry, and this simply hasn't happened. It hasn't happened with David Kelly. It hasn't happened with the London bombings. And it seems that we're living in a society now where justice is the least of the concerns of our leaders and politicians, and they seem to shy away from any idea of properly looking into some of the most controversial events of our time. What they'd rather do is brush them under the carpet, and this whole Chilcot business is exactly what the press want. It gives lots of sound bites, and we get Tony Blair sitting again looking embarrassed and squirming, but there's certainly none of the really hard evidence against him is available, because he and others have just said, oh, well, we've declined to hand this over to the inquiry.
I mean, you mentioned David Kelly, and documents regarding David Kelly, government documents, have been, you know, put away for a credible amount of time.
Yeah, they've been, yes, I think it's 70 years or something, rather than the normal 30 years. Look, this if there was a judicial inquiry, a public inquiry into the death of Dr. David Kelly, then, and in fact, in an inquest, this is supposed to be able to happen, but it didn't in this case, is all those documents should be handed over to the coroner, or the judge, if it's a public inquiry, and then they should be gone through by all of the jurors, etc., should be able to have a look at them, but that simply hasn't happened. And so it's very difficult to see how justice is going to be done in Britain today without some of our politicians and legal people really pushing for a reinstatement of proper public inquiries into any big disaster that happens, any kind of incident which may have political ramifications, like the death of David Kelly and the London bombings. And what we've got with the bombings, for example, at the moment, is this long-term inquest, which is entirely the wrong way to be looking at it. An inquest is designed to look at the death of a single individual. So what you've had here is a kind of rolling inquest, looking into the deaths of many people, with a whole load of different witnesses turning up. And what I've seen so far is that none of the important questions about the London bombings have even been addressed by this inquest. For example, things like the contradictions in evidence to do with what type of explosives may or may not have been used, the contacts that the four alleged bombers had with this guy, Haroon Rashid Aswat, who was, it's believed, certainly by John Loftus and others, to have been an MI6 agent working within Finsbury Park Mosque as a sort of undercover Islamic extremist. And the mosque people, I mean, we know this for a fact, that the people running the Finsbury Park Mosque were actually contacting the police and saying, we've got these very strange radical guys in here, and reporting them, but nothing was done. And the reason that nothing was done appears to be pretty clear, that this was being run by the British intelligence services, and that's why they went to the police and they said, well, don't do anything here, because these are our boys and we're infiltrating. You know, but actually what they were doing was controlling, and one of their people, this guy Haroon Rashid Aswat, was very much in touch with these four alleged 7/7 London bombers, and none of this has even been looked at by the inquest.
Indeed. I think nowadays, especially with the recent revelations that come out just in the last couple of weeks with Mark Kennedy et al., it shouldn't be difficult for people to believe now that such things can go on at all. It should be very out in the open now. But moving on to another topic, and that is, we were talking earlier in the show to Steve Jolly, and one of the things we spoke about was Tony Blair again, who is now calling for a war on Iran, the extension of the war on terror, if you like.
Well, I mean, you know, he's the man's a lunatic. I mean, in fact, he's not just a lunatic. He's a very, very dangerous lunatic, and I think he should be locked up in an asylum. Why does he want to have a war with Iran? What is this? I mean, is he just obsessed with having wars? You know, what's going on here is, I mean, it's interesting because I've been watching Russia Today and some of the other channels, and you see a completely different point of view from other parts of the world on what's going on in Iran, because it has actually been decided that it is quite lawful and legal for, as any fool should be able to figure out from the non-proliferation treaty, for the Iranians to enrich uranium. Now, what is going on here is that the US are attempting to spin this whole thing as a failure of the Iranians to negotiate. Actually, what they never seem to mention is that actually the Iranians do have a legitimate right to nuclear power. And the other thing that never gets mentioned in this whole discussion is the fact that the Israelis have something like 50 nuclear weapons themselves.
Okay, so getting back to Tony Blair and, of course, his obsession with war, the question would be that, you know, what would be the real reason, you know, not just for Tony Blair, but overall, you know, for, I'm assuming here that, of course, it would be the UK, America would be involved, perhaps even some European countries would be involved. Why would they really want to go into Iran?